They both don't have to be
when's the Havoc she remained? When's the Havoc she remained?
Okay, everybody, so we did an introduction to the Korbanos yesterday. Now I just want to look at the actual Korbanos and what they might mean. Remember that Rosh Hashanah, besides the daily offering, never changes, but Rosh Hashanah is a double holiday. It is both the first day of Tishrei, the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, thank you, and it is also Rosh Chodesh, it is the beginning of a month. Let me also remind you that Rosh Hashanah in the Torah is a one-day holiday, and the only reason we have 2 days is because of the calendrical uncertainty. It is not a two-day holiday as far as the Torah is concerned. So let's first make a list. Again, this will be a bit technical. I'll try to keep it straightforward. Let's make a list of the Rosh Chodesh Korban, and then we'll make a comparative list of the Rosh Hashanah Korban. The Rosh Chodesh, this is the Musaf, the additional offering. The Rosh Chodesh Korban is in Bamidbar, Perek Chavches, chapter 28, verse 11. And it says, the beginning of the year, I'm sorry, beginning of the month, Rosh Chodesh, Takrivu Ola Lashem, you shall bring a burnt offering. An ola is a korban that is totally burnt on the altar. There are no portions that are eaten by the kohanim. And what is that ola? Parim b'nei bakar shnayim, two bulls. Parim are male cows, bulls. Ayal echad, one ram. Kvasim b'nei shana shivat mimim, and seven young lambs. Okay, this is actually a very familiar korban pattern in the Torah. It is the famous 2-1-7, and these are burnt offerings. Two parim, one ayal, one ram, seven kvasim, seven sheep, and they are burnt offerings. There is nothing that is eaten by the priest or anybody else. It is burnt. Now, if you flip down a little bit to the Rosh Hashanah offering, and that's already chapter 29, that's the next chapter. Ubachodesh Hashvi'i, the seventh month. Now, remember in the Torah, although it's paradoxical, we begin our year in the seventh month. How could that be? I thought you begin your year in the first month, but remember that the way the Torah counts months is not the same as the way the Torah counts years. Years begin from the first of Tishrei. But months in the Torah always begin from the month of Nisan, because that is the month of the Exodus. So if you count the months from Nisan, Nisan is first month, Iyar is second month, Sivan is third month, Tammuz is fourth month, Av is fifth month, Elul is sixth month, Tishrei is seventh month. In fact, let me just digress for a little bit. The Torah has no names for months at all. The Torah only talks about first month, second month, third month, fourth month. There are no other names. The only names in the Torah are the counting from Nisan. So where did we get the names? Now we know all of our months have names. Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Teves. They are not from the Torah. They are in fact of Babylonian origin. They are of non-Jewish origin. and we picked them up when we were exiled. In other words, the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. This is the first temple. In the year, secular year, 586 BCE, the Jews were exiled to Babylonia, modern-day Iraq. The prophet who was there at the time of the destruction was Jeremiah. And when we were in Babylonia for 70 years, and we then came back and built the second temple, we picked up a number of non-Jewish practices, strangely enough. And one of those non-Jewish practices were names of the months that were actually of Babylonian or Assyrian origin. Now the question would be, why should we keep them as a religious matter? Okay, that's a very good question. I'll try to answer that. But let me point out, in spite of the fact that these months are of non-Jewish origin, they are mentioned in the later biblical books of the Tanakh that are post-exile. They're not in the Torah. But what books will mention it? The book of Esther mentions it, because the story of Esther was after the destruction of the temple, between the two temples. The books of Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. These are all books after the Babylonian exile. And it's interesting, you know, just like, you know, whenever you change from one, I mean, of course, people want the United States to change to the metric system, because the United States is the only civilized country in the world that hasn't yet gone to the metric system. And the truth is, it's too hard for any American to change. We can't change our ways. That's why the whole world learns English, but you know, we can't learn any other language. But be it as it may, obviously when you're changing over to a new system, you have to have conversions. So it'll say 1 mile, 2/3 kilometers. You need both. So it's fascinating. The book of Esther, the story of Esther, is a transition from the old system of dating, which is first month, second month, third month, to the new system of dating, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev. So that's why whenever the story of Esther gives you a date, it always gives you both things. So it'll say the following: the miracle of Purim happens in the month of Adar, which is the 12th month. See why? Because 12th month is what the Torah would call it, because Adar is the last month of the year when you count from Nisan. But we're using the new name nomenclature, which is Adar, so that's why it gives you both. See, in the books that are later than that, we just say Adar, because everybody knows what Adar is. But Esther is literally the transition to the new dating system. So it will say that we celebrate Purim on the 14th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So it's in the Bible, but not in the Torah. It's in the later biblical books after the Babylonian exile. Now, the big question you might ask is, so why do we keep these names? Why did we take these names, and why do we keep these names? They're not of Jewish origin. And in fact, not only that, but in Kabbalah, we give mystical interpretations of these names. And they are said to have spiritual meanings. Even Elul, I discussed, I think last week, the week before, that Elul, which again is originally a non-Jewish name, is encoded in various verses. I am for my beloved is for me. But it's a non-Jewish name. So Ramban, Nachmanides, offers the following explanation. He points out an interesting phenomenon in Hebrew. Just as the Torah does not give you names of months, every month is first month, second month, third month, fourth month, so too, even today, Hebrew does not have any words for name of the week. Sunday, first day, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day. The only day that has a name is Shabbos. And Sunday is simply called first day towards the Shabbos. Second day towards the Shabbos. Meaning, the whole week doesn't count. It's just a count down, or a count up, to Shabbos. So the Ramban says, you know why that's so? Because the fourth commandment of the Ten Commandments says, remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. Now remembering doesn't mean when it's on Shabbos, that's not remembering. Every single day, we are supposed to think of Shabbos and remember it and cherish it. And the way symbolically we do that, one of the ways, is that even when I talk about what day it is in Hebrew, I say, oh, this is the first day towards the Shabbos. The Ramban actually says it is a fulfillment, if you think about it, it is a fulfillment of the commandment. Remember the day of Shabbos. In fact, some people even say, you know, when we say the daily psalm at the end of davening, today is the fourth day of towards the Shabbos, there we actually say, Lish Shabbat, towards the Shabbos. Some people actually add, and I intend to fulfill the commandments. Some sitters have it. Remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. Now, there's an interesting argument between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai, or Shammai, not Beis Shammai, not the house of Shammai, Shammai himself, the way he remembered Shabbos was every time he bought something, he only bought something for Shabbos. So if he would buy, at least for food, if he would go to the market and buy some food, he would say, I'm buying this for Shabbos. If the next day he encountered something better, he would then say, okay, I'm buying this better thing for Shabbos and I'll eat the thing I bought yesterday. Every single purchase was in honor of Shabbos. Hillel says not to do that. Hillel says, take life one day at a time. But even Hillel says, yeah, I'll answer. I know people want to ask questions. I'll get to you in a second. I just want to finish a thought. Hillel says, you know, take it one day at a time. But even Hillel, we remember the Shabbos by the days of the week. So here's what Ramban says. The reason why the Torah talks about first month, second month, third month in the Torah is the same way by the days of the week we think about Shabbos. When we talk about the months of the year, by calling something the first month of the Exodus, second month from the Exodus, what are we remembering? That God took us out of Egypt. And that's a mitzvah too. You got to remember Shabbos every day, and you got to remember that Hashem took us out of Egypt every day. But the Ramban now superimposes it. When we left Babylonia and we were able to rebuild the second temple, that was also a redemption of sorts. Now, it was not as miraculous as the redemption from Egypt. We didn't have the 10 plagues and everything else, but it was a redemption from exile. So Ramban says, the reason we took the Babylonian names is that now, if you ask me what month it is, and I say Elul, and you think, hey, that's Babylonian, it reminds you, gee, God took us out of that Babylonian exile. And that's a very important message, because although we're back in exile again, but the same way God took us out of the Babylonian exile when the first temple was destroyed, he's going to take us out of this exile when the second temple was destroyed and will bring us back. Of course, we're already back in Eretz Yisrael physically, but we don't yet have the Mashiach, we don't yet have the building of the temple. So you see the Ramban's idea. Days of the week reminds you of Shabbos. Names of the months in the Torah remind you of the Exodus. Babylonian names of the months remind you of God's redeeming us from the Babylonian exile. Did you want something?
So if on a Tuesday we think to ourselves, it's Shabbos in 3 days, have we just done a mitzvah?
Yes.
That's
yes. Yeah, pretty easy mitzvah.
Now, what other things?
So when you have a bumper sticker, TGIF, thank God it's Friday, doing a mitzvah actually. Although, perhaps people who are thinking about it are not thinking about Shabbos per se. But if you think about Shabbos, TGIF becomes a mitzvah.
And what other things are we told to remember?
Well, there are 6 things we remember. We have to remember that God gave us the Torah at Mount Sinai. We have to remember the Shabbat. We have to remember the leprosy that God gave Miriam because she spoke Lashon Hara against Moshe. We have to remember the evil of Amalek and never allow that to happen again. These are things that we remember, right? We think about them. If you look in the Siddur, after the morning prayers, there will be a section that's called six remembrances, six zechiros, six things that you remember. Some people say them every day, other people just think them, but it's good to look at it.
If you do those every day, it's like an extra 40-something.
You get some extra mitzvahs, six extra mitzvahs every day. Yeah, that's right. But as I say, even if you just say the daily psalm, if you think about Shabbos, you have that mitzvah, because you say, today is the fourth day of the Shabbat, towards the Shabbos, right? So you're thinking about Shabbos.
And how would you do that? Because in my Siddur it says, like, remember the Exodus. I just sort of try and visualize, like, plagues and stuff.
Well, you don't have to have a full-fledged Ten Commandments movie. You don't need... No, it's basically to be grateful to God, that God gave us freedom from slavery, that we could serve Him. And that's it. You know, just think
so
about the
gratitude.
No, it's not visualization so much. It's really the gratitude to Hashem for giving us freedom, giving our ancestors freedom. Otherwise, we would have been assimilated. We would have been we would have disappeared. I'm sorry. Did you? You had a question?
Yeah. So I remember learning a while ago that there were actually some months had more than one name that we don't use anymore.
Yeah. That is correct. Yeah.
I was wondering. Where those other names came from? I think they also came from Babylonia, but and why we don't use them?
It's a mix. There are actually some names that even appear in the early parts of the Bible that are authentic Hebrew names of months, and those we don't use. For example, the month of Cheshvan was called Bul, and Bul is connected to Mabul, flood, because that was the month of the flood. Other names refer to agricultural cycles, the rainy seasons, the sun, etc. So again, there were different names. Why the sages chose to use these ones are primarily because of the Babylonian connection. But also, again, a lot of things have mystical reasons that are below the surface. So for example, I'm sure you've heard, there's a whole genre of Hasidic story. These are stories about, I'm sure you've heard stories like this, about some Hasidic tunes, songs, are based on non-Jewish peasant melodies. And they have the story that a Rebbe was once walking in the forest, and the Rebbe hears some peasant, non-Jewish peasants, illiterate, drunk even, who's singing a love song. And the Rebbe asks the peasant, repeat the song, and the peasant repeats it five times till the Rebbe knows the song. And then the peasant forgot it. The Rebbe reclaimed it. And the way the Hasidim explain is that this is a song that's a love song to God, but somehow it got disattached from holiness, and somebody picked it up, and the Rebbe was there to reclaim it. The point I'm making with that type of story is that there is a mystical belief that even if things are from non-Jewish sources, there may sometimes be sparks of holiness that are within them that have to be reclaimed. So yeah, it happens to be the non-Jewish source had it, but there's something much deeper. So the non-Jew may have thought one thing when he called it Elo, but we have other meanings that are even encoded in the Torah itself. So there are ultimately mystical reasons. The names of the months are very, very deep, but historically they are connected to Babylonian and Assyrian names. Yeah?
I think it's off topic, but in terms of that throne period story,
yes.
Is that assuming that no one else knew that too?
Well, I think the story is making that assumption. Yeah, I can't historically test it out. But this is a well-known idea in Kabbalah called the breaking of the vessels and the scattering of the sparks. And one of the functions of the righteous is to gather the scattered sparks of holiness and bring them home. That's a very, very well-known idea from the Arizal. Yeah.
So do we say the same thing, by the way, like the church broke down the Chumash, like the numbering system that we still used to say, that there's Kedusha to that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. I think the consensus is there isn't Kedusha, but you know, you're asking why can't you make the same argument. I guess you need only the greatest Chachamim to be able to make that determination, meaning some stuff is holy and some stuff isn't. And it may be hard for us to know what non-Jewish input has this holiness behind it and what non-Jewish input does not. And you know, I don't necessarily have a litmus test, but it's an interesting observation. Again, in case not everybody got that, I hope you all know that the division of the Tanakh into chapters is of non-Jewish origin. It is not Jewish, meaning the Torah is divided into verses. The verses are from God, but the notion of chapters is simply a printing convention that was introduced by the Catholic Church, and therefore I use it just because it's a convenient reference system, but it has no significance. And that is why, as far as we're concerned, the fact that something's in chapter 28 and something's in chapter 29 means nothing, two different chapters, because really it's all the same. Okay, this was digression on digression, but to go back to the sacrifices, again, I just want to make a list of two. That is, the Korban of Rosh Chodesh are two bulls, one ram, seven sheep. Now, if you look at chapter 29, verse 1, on the seventh month, on the first of the month, you bring one bull, one ram, and seven sheep. So the difference is very, very simple. Rosh Chodesh, 2, 1, 7. Rosh Hashanah, 1, 1, 7. The only change, paradoxically, is instead of two bulls, you went down to one bull. Now, keep in mind, though, that actually means you have to add up the two numbers. So the total number of sacrifices, right, are three bulls, two rams, and 14 sheep. Because on Rosh Hashanah, you also got to bring Rosh Chodesh. But at first glance, it's hard to understand how could Rosh Hashanah be less significant, so to speak, than Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh is not even a holiday. It's semi-festive. Rosh Hashanah, like one of the most important days of the whole year. So let me share with you a thought generally from one of the great, great Mefarshim on Chumash. He was an Italian rabbi of the Renaissance, Rabbi Ovadia Sforno. Many of you probably have heard the name Sforno. Sforno is his last name. In those days, they already had last names. Rabbi Ovadia Sforno, he was also a doctor. Part of his parnasa, halachically strange, part of his parnasa was he was a Hebrew teacher to clerics in the Catholic Church. So he got paid fairly well for that. All sorts of halachic questions, are you allowed to teach? But putting that aside, he did write one of the greatest great biblical commentaries on the Chumash, and every Mikros Gedolos, any Chumash with commentaries, will have his comments. He's very short, though. He's not long at all. And we refer to him as the Sforno. That's how we refer to him, but he is Rabbi Ovadia Sforno, 1500s in Italy. And he offers the following symbolic idea. If we remember what we discussed yesterday from the Ramban, that korbanos are not so much about giving God meat, but korbanos are valid or important because of the symbolic effect they have on the worshiper. So he wants to say the following. A bull represents strength, might, force, right? A bull is an extremely powerful animal. You don't want to be around a bull when a bull gets in a bad mood. So a bull, we can say, symbolically represents strength. A human being's strength, now what is a human being's strength? A human being's strength is not their muscle. A human being's strength is their intellect and their perception and their understanding. That is the strength of man. So when we talk about two bulls, the symbol of two bulls is that a human being should have two sources of strength and understanding in their relationship to God. And those two sources are the midah of love of God and fear of God. Right? We talk about serving God. I'm going to qualify what I mean by fear in a moment. We talk about serving God through love and serving God through fear. Now, by fear, there are different types of fear. There is the lowest type of fear, which is fear of punishment, meaning I better behave or I'll get in trouble. And that is an appropriate motivator that we need to know, that there is such a thing as accountability. But what we really mean by fear is not so much fright, but fear really means reverence, awe. That you love, not you love, you revere God. I mean, again, this is different than fear of punishment. There's fear of punishment, and then there is awe and reverence and a sense of God's awesomeness and power. Even in human relationships, we have this. You know, in the olden days, or maybe in some countries even today, if you behave disrespectfully in front of a king, you might get killed. So you were afraid. Now today, let's say Queen Elizabeth would walk into this room, or Barack Obama. Well, maybe the U.S. presidents may be different. Israel presidents, for sure, wouldn't necessarily trigger any big reaction, or the like. Now, we would be on our best behavior. We would, you know, we would straighten up ourselves, clean up a little bit, etc. And not because Queen Elizabeth is going to kill you. Even in London, she's not going to kill you. But there's a certain kind of respect for the position. This is not fear of punishment. This is awe and reverence. Well, if that's so for a human being, how much more so for the Almighty, that God's glory fills the universe. So that's what I mean by fear, that you have a sense of reverence of God. But at the same time, simultaneously with that reverence of God, you have to feel love and intimacy and closeness and friendship. And you serve God not merely out of fear, you also try to serve God out of love. But you see, you need both. Because if one loves God, love is higher than fear. That's very true. Love is higher than fear. But if you only serve God out of love, he becomes like your buddy. You take him for granted. So you need that sense of reverence and awe. But you also need the sense of intimacy and closeness. That's why in every bracha, if you ever think about this, every bracha we recite is grammatically incorrect. Let's take the bracha for water. Baruch atah Hashem. Blessed art you, God. I'm speaking to God in second person. Shahakol nihya bidvaro. Everything came into existence through his word. You switched in mid-bracha from second person to third person. You should say, if you want to be grammatically consistent, you should say, Baruch atah Hashem, Shahakol niyeh bidvarecha. Everything came into existence by your word. Why do I say, blessed art you, God? Everything came into existence by his word. Switching from second person to third person. So the Mefarshim explain that the meaning of this shift is second person represents friendship and closeness. You know, when you're my buddy, I'm talking to you. You, hey, right? Just not in English, but in many, many languages, right? French, tu versus vous. Right, in Yiddish as well, we have a distinction between the friendly. In fact, Old English had that as well. That was the difference between you and thou. All those these and thous. That you is the familiar, and thou is the reverential. Now in English, that got extinct. But many languages still preserve it. So you connotes immediacy, intimacy, friendship. The third person is awe and reverence. So every bracha, in a little bracha, that's how marvelous Hebrew is, in a little bracha, we encapsulate and bring together the two ways we relate to God. God is my king. God is my master. I am his slave. God is my father. I am his child. Avinu Malkeinu, our father, our king. Our Father is the relationship of love. our king is the relationship of law and reverence.
How do you love a beat like Isabel Schubert, like God, something you didn't even know existed up until recently? How do you feel love for someone you've never met?
Well, I think a person feels love primarily by cultivating gratitude. That's really what it is. You know, you look at life and we try to develop within our personalities gratitude for things. Gratitude for health, gratitude for being able to think, gratitude for being able to learn. Every person identifies. And when you have gratitude, that's why you remember the Exodus and all those other things. But even in your own life, maybe more so in your own life, you think about the reasons to be grateful. And then you feel love. You feel love because I'm grateful because God put me in this world with so many good things.
Aren't we meant to see this world as fleeting pleasures?
Let me put it this way. We're not supposed to look at this world as the ultimate destination. But I think you're raising a very important point. It is important not to disparage things too much. You know, a religious sensibility appreciates beauty, looks at colors and music, looks at the grass, looks at the flowers. You appreciate life. You're grateful to God for this life. You don't shut your eyes to things too much. Because if you shut your eyes to the beauty in the world, again, I'm referring to halakhically permissible forms, I'm not referring to, then your religious sensibility atrophies. Well, again, it's a point that maybe you need to hear this, because sometimes you might be getting, by implication perhaps, opposite messages. But if you look at the Sefer like the Chovos HaLevavos, Duties of the Heart, he very much talks about appreciating the beauty and good things in the world as a way of enhancing your love of God. Now, Rabbi Avigdor Miller was a great rabbi. He just died a few years ago. He was well into his 90s. He once wrote a 20-page essay, I can't really do it justice, about how to eat an apple and a banana. And he talked about meditating on the color and on the tangy, you know, acidity on your tongue. And how God could have made food like mush, but instead he created, of course, sometimes that's how it comes out of the kitchen. But ideally, you know, you have different colors and different smells. And why did God make music? Who needs music? I mean, you could live without music. You're not going to die. But God put things into the world to enhance beauty and joy in life. And those are the things that help you love God, because, you know, you really think, Now I know people are going to say, well, the world is so filled with suffering. The world is so filled with tragedy. Besides the Holocaust, I mean, good, but what about the people in Syria? Although, once again, the Syrians are hardly our friends. But still, one has to commiserate with the suffering of children and the like. Well, there is a lot of suffering in the world. There is no question. And that deserves a very, very long talk in and of itself. But at the same time, you can't deny the good that is in the world. And you come to love God when you have that sense of appreciation. Okay, so going back to the Saporno. The Saporno's point is, the two bulls that we push are the two strengths that we have based on our intellect and our emotion. And that is serving God through reverence and awe, and serving God through love and friendship. Those are the two bulls. Now, based on that, the Saporno wants to say, that is why on Rosh Hashanah, the Rosh Hashanah offering loses one. Because on Rosh Hashanah, the dominant aspect is more of a fear and reverence aspect. Because Rosh Hashanah is the day of judgment. You know, it is the, we don't say Hallel. On most holidays, we say the joyous Hallel. On Rosh Hashanah, we don't say Hallel, because the books of life and death are open, so we have to be very serious. Right? Rosh Hashanah is not like January 1st, right? You don't get drunk and fool around. You shouldn't do that any day of the year. But Rosh Hashanah is a very serious New Year. So the Saporno emphasizes that we minimize a little bit the Korban of love, because Rosh Hashanah is a time of a little bit more trepidation and the like. Now, let's go to the next level of animal, which is the same for Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Chodesh, and that is one ram. So here, the Soporno says the following. The Soporno says that if the bowls are the strength of a human, which are their perception of how they relate to God, the ram deals with, okay, now that I relate to God, how do I emulate God? We're supposed to imitate God. Now, how do I imitate God? Well, there's only one way to imitate God. Our sages say, just as God is merciful and compassionate, you must emulate God in that way. Meaning, you don't emulate God's vengeance. God sometimes wreaks vengeance on evildoers. But you don't emulate God in that way. You emulate God only in one way, and that is by taking the positive attributes. So the bulls are the intellectual way we perceive God. The ram, the single ram, is the way we emulate God, as opposed to, we don't take two rams, because that would indicate I emulate God's qualities of vengeance against evildoers, and that is not for me to do. Only God does that revenge. Now, sheep, seven sheep. So here we know that sheep is actually a symbol of blind obedience, right? We talk about, you know, sheep are actually, as you know, sheep are actually pretty blind. Look, I once saw, I didn't see the book, I saw it referred to. You know, everyone knows the 23rd Psalm, right? The Lord is my shepherd is one of the most famous passages. Even non-Jews know it well. So I once heard of a book written by a Christian Arab shepherd. And he made this fascinating point. He says, you know, you guys don't know what it means to be a shepherd, so you don't know what it means when you say God is my shepherd. Unless you've been a shepherd, you really don't get the metaphor. That's a pretty good criticism. And he describes what it means to be a shepherd. He says, these sheep are very frightened little animals. They don't see well. They're nervous, they're skittish, they're afraid they're going to fall, because they know instinctively that if they fall, they won't be able to stand up again because they're too top-heavy with all their wool. So they're skittish and frightened and running around. And the shepherd, just as our midrashim say, sometimes has to carry the sheep over the water. Just as Moshe Rabbeinu became a leader only because he was able to take care of little sheep. And then you realize that what we're saying is, we're a bunch of sheep. We're scared. We're frightened. We're not sure where to go. We don't see ahead of us that well in terms of the long-term future. And God is the shepherd that protects us and nurtures us and takes care of us. Actually, very beautiful. The truth of the matter is, if you do want to understand any passage in Tanakh, you know, that talks about shepherds and sheep, you know, you really need to go back to the soil and see what it's like. You know, the urban Jew who's never seen a sheep, and I include, you know, I mean, I've seen sheep, but I include myself as mainly an urban guy, we really don't understand these things. I thought that was a very valuable way of interpreting the Tehillim. But sheep do travel in mass, like blind, kind of, they go in groups, that gives them security. So blind obedience. And seven is the 7 days of the week, the whole week. So the Soporno says, the backdrop of the Musaf is the following. The two bulls, which represent muscle and might and strength, are the two ways I relate to God emotionally. Reverence of God, and intimacy and love. The ram is the one way that I emulate God, imitate God, and that is by following his ways of compassion and goodness, and not following whatever revenge or justice that God needs to mete out, because we can't make those judgments. And finally, unconditional submission, like a sheep, to the totality of God's commandments for the entirety of my week, which is seven. And the ram and the sheep are the same for Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Chodesh. The only difference is, on Rosh Chodesh we have the love and the reverence. On Rosh Hashanah we emphasize more the reverence. So you still have the Rosh Chodesh offering of the two, but Rosh Hashanah is an extra dose of reverence. So effectively, of the three cows, of three bulls, two are reverence, one is love. So the reverence is one. Now, again, we don't have time, maybe at some other time. The Sephorno then goes through every single holiday and shows that all of the differences are really reflective of this three-level point, and that is perception of God, emulation of God, and submission through obedience. And that's kind of the structure that he imposes on the sacrifices. Okay? So now you have a sense. Now, there's one other sacrifice I need to mention. I'm going to leave you with a very perplexing Gemara. In addition to these sacrifices that were burnt offerings, there was actually a sin offering that was brought of a goat. And halachically, a sin offering, part of it is burnt on the altar, and part of it, the meat, is eaten by the Kohanim. So it's different than an ola. An ola is totally burnt on the altar. A sin offering, part is on the altar, and part is eaten by the Kohanim. Why is there a sin offering on Rosh Chodesh and on Rosh Hashanah? So I'm going to tell you a Gemara, but I'm going to leave its explanation for later. God says, bring an atonement for me because I diminish the moon. Do you remember this? This is a medrash that says originally God created the sun and the moon of equal size, and not only that, but the moon generated its own light. They were equal. The sun was the king of the day. The moon was the king of the night. Now, of course, there's a big problem here. If the moon had its own light, why would it ever be dark? Okay, that's a good question. But putting that aside, the concept would be the sun rules over the day and the moon rules over the night. But the moon complained. The moon said to God, hey, God, you can't have two kings that are equal. You got to make somebody the boss. Thinking, of course, God would choose the moon for coming up with that brilliant idea. God said, you're right, there needs to be one king, so I'm diminishing you. You're smaller, you're not going to have your own light, I'm going to make the sun the boss. So it mentions, the Talmud says, that God feels, it's so mystical, I'm just telling you what the Gemara says, that he sinned against the moon. So every Rosh Chodesh, God says, bring a sin offering for my atonement, my meaning God's atonement, because I diminished the light of the moon. The Korban Chatas, not the Ola, the sin offering of Rosh Chodesh, actually not Rosh Hashanah per se, but the Rosh Chodesh sin offering, which is also brought on Rosh Chodesh, is said to be an atonement for the Almighty himself. Obviously, this is real, real hard to understand. Why don't you give it some thought? Next time we meet, we'll discuss it. Anyway, I think this is it till after Rosh Hashanah. But anyway, wish you all a good Geben Shdior, Ksivach Sima Taiva, and may all of our tefillos be accepted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu.